There was an active pony track. Snacks such as popcorn, candy, soda, ice cream, roasted peanuts were sold to hungry patrons. To get anything more potent to drink, since the park was resting on Chatham's, quote, dry zone, one had to rent a paddle boat and cruise to Holly Point, one of two islands within the lake known as, quote, rest areas. Some things never change. And is recorded on Kinderhook Lake Corporation's website. So the Kinderhook Lake Corporation has a little bit of information about this. Later, a rickety wooden bridge was constructed by breaking through the frozen lake water to create easier access. A dance hall, restaurant, bowling alley, shooting gallery, theater were also part of the fun. There were two performances each day at the theater for plays, vaudeville shows, and later, movies. To increase attendance, ads ran in the Chatham Courier for the park and noted some remarkable performances to be witnessed. In one ad was the description of an astonishing Professor Joe D'Amico, who could play the violin behind his back, over his head, and in 100 different positions. He would also play charming and enchanting music on a tomato can violin with only one string. The ad continued to promote the talent of Professor Ghirardi of Philadelphia, who could offer the best sleight of hand and pleasing tricks, and a woman without a body who could drink water. There was a New York troupe offering plantation songs, Irish music, clog ballet, and fancy dancing. But last but not least, it is told of the appearance of the ossified man who hadn't been moved in 26 years. Sounds like quite the mix. But this park would never have been put on the map if it had not been for Charles Delamere Haynes. Charles D., as his brothers and his brothers, established the original Kinderhook Lake Park 30 years prior to the Electric Park as a place for people to meet, picnic, play games, and fish. So way before they got it electrified by the trolley company, there was a picnic place, it was an outings, and this gentleman was part of the original railroad, he sort of made claim to fame, and he tried to revive it after it died, because he came back and it was his beloved place, but it really didn't have a second life after it fell to like all of the big places, you know, it just got stopped being used, and then it was kind of deteriorated. There was an attempt in 1917, but it closed for good in 1921. So that's kind of an interesting place. And if you drive by there, you can see maybe perhaps where the trolley path was along the edge of the creek or the lake. And if you drive up East Drive, the gates are still there, the stone gates. And there's a little island where they used to give you booze. It's called One Tree Island, and it still has one tree. I wonder if the whole of Kinderhook knows that, or Kinderhook Lake knows that. But somehow the water theme seems to be running here. And a little closer to home here in Hudson. Yeah. Is everyone from Hudson? Are you guys all from this area? Yeah. Some other folks. Where are you from?
I'm from Southern California.
You're from
moved here in July. We have no idea where New Lebanon is.
Okay. Afterwards, we'll chat about it.
I'm from Kansas.
You're from Kansas. Okay. We have some local folks.
Been
here
a year and a half.
Okay, so you're a new transplant.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. Well, you're in the town here in Hudson. It's just amazing history. And one of the most interesting parts of this research for me was finding a gentleman named John Worth Edmonds, who lived in Hudson and in the 1850s, and he was a very prominent lawyer. I'll read a little bit of this. And he had an interesting evolution. He became a leader of spiritualism. And the spiritualist movement attested that souls of the dead resided in an astral plane and could communicate with the living. through traveling medium shows that exhibited spirit wrappings, table tippings, thought readings, as well as published communiques from famous dead people, the belief of spiritualism spread quickly across America. One of Hudson's most unusual residents in particular was responsible for putting spiritualism on the map. John Worth Edmonds was born in Hudson in 1799. Spiritualists believed that they could communicate with the dead, and in the Spirit Book, the Encyclopedia of Clairvoyance, Channeling, and Spirit, the author says that Edmonds is the man who has done the most to make the movement of spiritualism the vital force and power that it has become. Around the time Edmonds turned 18, he studied law and entered Martin Van Buren's law practice in Albany. Anyone know that? Everyone should know that Martin Van Buren retired here at Lindenwald after his presidency. And then Lindenwald's in Kinderhook, not too far away. We could talk a lot about Linden. We can talk a lot about Martin Van Buren.
Didn't he practice law in Hudson?
He did. So this gentleman joined his law practice. He succeeded in becoming both part of the branch of legislature of New York and president of the Senate and judge on the Supreme Court of New York. Edmonds also was noted for having overseen the trial of Big Thunder during the anti-rent wars. During a heated debate between the two lawyers presiding over Big Thunder's case, John Edmonds put Martin Van Buren's son, John, and Ambrose Jordan in jail overnight. They had a big fight in the courtroom. He put them both in jail. Edmonds was, in every sense of the phrase, a straight and upstanding citizen, yet he became drawn to spiritualism after a period of deep depression and contemplation following his wife's death, during which he questioned whether what he had heard from preachers was true, and whether there was indeed life after death. Edmonds first tried to prove that spiritualism movement was fraudulent, but he then became a first-hand witness to mental and physical mediums. He became so convinced that what he was seeing was true that he kept a 1,600-page meticulous record. When Judge Edmonds went public with his findings in the book in 1853, simply titled Spiritualism, he was attacked by the press, the church, politicians, and was forced to resign his post on the bench and return to a private practice. It was about the time that Edmonds developed his own abilities as a medium, and began in between the years of 1853 and 1854, he and a group of friends received many communications. They held seances here in Hudson. His daughter also became a spiritualist, and his best-known writings are in two volumes called Spiritualism, and his message in the book was that it would be a real gift if you could speak to the dead. And the rise in spiritualism really grew so rapidly. Millions of people were involved in this in that time period, including people like Elizabeth Barrett Browning, William Cullen Bryant, Edgar Allan Poe, Queen Victoria, Harriet Beecher Stowe, Mark Twain, a lot of really noted writers. So he lives here, or lived here, and he is now buried with his wife in the same grave in the Hudson Cemetery. That's pretty interesting to me. So about the place that we're sitting, should we talk a little bit, or you want to talk about how we're doing on time? We got 20 minutes. I want to talk about poets first, and then we'll talk about the library, because we may want to chat about what everybody knows about the library. I spent a year and a half consulting with the Edna St. Vincent Millay Society doing fundraising. I built their fundraising program in the last year and a half. So I got the pleasure of living pretty much up at Steepletop, and I'm not here as an official representative of their organization, but it's a very magical place on the edge of Austerlitz, off of Route 22. If you're looking for the post office in Austerlitz, there's a road, East Hill Road, you drive 2 miles up a dirt path, and you're there. And that's her home between 1925 and 1950 when she died, in the home. And Edna St. Vincent Millay, everyone heard of her? Mm-hmm. She was the first female Pulitzer winner. And she began her career as a 19-year-old poet up in Rockland, Maine, Camden, Maine area, and she wrote a poem called Renaissance. And it was published in a contest for the Lyric Year, which was a volume of poetry at the time. And because her name was Edna St. Vincent, she wrote E as V Vincent. They thought she was a man, so they gave her like honorary mention. But she made such a stink about not getting chosen to win. And there was all she did this like PR campaign where she went out to everyone and had them write to the editors, and she, so that the guy who actually won the prize felt so bad because he thought her poem was better. He like rescinded the money and just decided that she should get, so it made this huge press impression on people. And she got like, it's like today when, you know, celebrities do something and they get in the press. That's exactly what happened. It was quite a stir. So then she won the honorary mention, and then she was at the Whitehall in Camden, this hotel. And she her mom was sort of like a pageant mom. I hate using that term, but she really like pushed her kids to succeed. And she was pushing her daughter, saying, go read your poem, read your poem. So she got up at the Whitehall and she read Renaissance, which is a 214-line lyric poem. And it's gorgeous. It has a transcendent feeling. And in the room was a woman who was just overwhelmed by her talent and decided to sponsor her at Vassar College because the Millay family was very poor. They lived in a very modest home. The mom and dad were divorced. It's a very modern story, and the mom was doing odd jobs and nursing and doing all kinds of things. So this woman by the name of Davin, I think her name was, she paid her way to Vassar. So she got into, she went and did some pre-courses, got to Vassar, and it really launched her into the whole world of New York literati, and she was brilliant. I mean, to Millay's, Millay was brilliant. She just was a brilliant pianist. She was a scholar. She was just well intelligent. She had chutzpah. She didn't take any from anybody. She barreled her way through a very male-dominated world of literature. She found her way. She won the Pulitzer in 23. She ended up marrying a man named Eugen Boissevin. He was an importer, and they eventually found an ad in the New York Times for a house. How many times have people ended in Hudson? I love this story. Oh, honey, let's go look at this house, right? So she goes and travels all the way up from the city to, on Route 22, finds this old farm, and they buy 800 acres, a farmhouse, and they end up in Austria. So I love the story of Millay, and I was thrilled to work for them for so long. And if you haven't seen it, you should go visit the house. It's really like a time capsule. Nothing was moved after the day she died in 1950. Her sister came and preserved the entire place. It's very interesting. The feeling, the whole aura of the place is great. And she was an outspoken individual. She protested the war. She was arrested in Boston during the trial of Sacco and Vanzetti. They were executed. And she had she was very much breaking the glass ceiling for women early on. She's one of those people we all should be thanking. And she also wrote incredibly well, beautiful poetry. And I wish I had a poem to read of hers. I don't think I published one in the book, but I'll leave that for you to do tonight when you go on the internet. You can pick something beautiful. The Buck in the Snow. There's just so many beautiful poems to be delighted about. So I really have great affinity for her, and I will continue to follow what the Millay Society does with Steepletop. It's open for tours. You can go visit. So about where we are today in the Hudson Library. So I almost feel like I have very little knowledge by comparison to how much knowledge you might all have. But I'll offer up what I found, which I know it was an almshouse, is that not right? Which was a home for the orphanage?
Home for the poor.
Home for the poor, right. Home for the poor. Yes, of course.
The orphanage came later.
That's right. So Vicki, can tell us right now. Come on, let's hear it.
Jones are
right there. All right, come on. Help me out here. What do you know?
Let me just look this up.
It was an almshouse.
Almshouse till the early 1840s.
It was built in 1818.
As an almshouse.
Almost 200 years.
And it, by the way, just as a fun fact, in 1778, it was law that cities and towns take care of the poor. That was the rule. Towns like Hudson and Ghent prepared and maintained poorhouses. So there were several. Prior to that, the poor were the responsibility of individual families. So if you had a relative, they live with you. The word alms is from an Old English, and it means pity or merciful, and can be traced back to the Christian and Buddhist religions. So that word has been around for a while. The first recorded almshouse was in Winchester. And in the Middle Ages, the majority of European hospitals functioned as almshouses, so people who were poor could certainly be taken care of. Then after the poorhouse, it relocated, according to my research, the city relocated the residents of its almshouses to a poor farm farther out of town. The building was then taken over by Samuel White for the establishment of the insane asylum under the private auspices and supervision of Dr. G.H. White. So it became an insane asylum.
Who had quite novel, new ideas about dealing with the insane.
Yes, this particular doctor.
So that's in the 1840s?
Yeah.
Oh, let me think, yeah.
And then he died after only maybe 10 years.
Yeah, in 1850 it became the academy.
And they moved up to, like, Albany,
right.
The hospital.
So Dr. White, he, according to this research, it was in a newspaper in Connecticut, I think. In the first 10 years it was open, 300 patients were admitted.
Wow.
Most of which they were cured under his work. And all were benefited. The very nature of lunatic asylums is an unsettling proposition for both its inhabitants and the towns in which they reside. The caretakers of the town usually are very, note when an asylum is in town. Their very walls, of which we sit, speak of deep-seated suffering. While Columbia County was heralded for its spectacular scenery and healthful attributes, it also attracted its fair share of troubled souls. Dr. White, however, had a very remarkable reputation. He was born in Connecticut in 1777. He began his professional career in Hudson, New York, in 1797. Because the doctor had experienced insanity in his own family, he was led to study mental disorders. His reputation as a surgeon as well as a general practitioner and his success as an alienist made him known throughout the state. The word alien in this context refers to mental illness, with alienism being the study and the treatment of mental disorders, especially in the relationship to legal problems. Alienists are also referred to as mad doctors in this time frame. The term is derived from the French word alienation and the Latin word alienus, or belonging to another. I had to do that root analysis for some reason. The asylum closed and the state mental hospital opened in Utica, so everyone went to Utica. In 1851, the Hudson Female Academy was established in the building under the direction of Reverend Haig. The school enjoyed a, quote, high reputation and attracted students from as far away as Detroit, Milwaukee, and the West Indies in Europe. Let's see, then they moved the academy. They moved it to the corner of First and Warren Streets in 1878. And that was in Ellis's history book.
Yeah.
So that moved, and then once that was relocated, George Power.
Power.
I have George H. Power.
Yeah.
He developed the ferries here in Hudson.
He took control over, he had control over all three water systems
down
there.
Yeah, he was a big, big gun.
He didn't found
them,
but he gained control of them.
And he was from Adams, Massachusetts, and he was pretty much, he founded the freighting firm of Power, Livingston and Company here in Hudson, and he had the first steamboat in Hudson, the Bolivar. So there's more about him, but I don't, once it became, this building was sold to the Hudson Orphan and Relief Association after that, and today it is a library. So it's seen a lot of stuff in these walls. So I think what I'll do is, if you guys have any questions, we can do that, and then I'll run through a couple of really fun photographs.
Did this building serve as living quarters for the girls in the
For the academy? As far as I know, it was all...
I guess it was housing for all these different groups of people.
Yeah, it was like a residential
lived in this
place.
Building.
Yeah. I mean, there's some photographs. I have some great photos here of that, so...
So upstairs was a lot of dorm rooms?
There are a lot of rooms upstairs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have you ever done tours? We've done tours of the building.
Not recently.
That's a good idea.
There hasn't been much demand for it.
We'll have to see.
Maybe now that we're moving, there'll be more demand.
Yeah, it's a marketing challenge.
Yeah.
It's a really a great building. I love this building. It's just a beautiful.
Yeah, it was a
hit,
like,
you know,
history,
the
history of
the
walking
lines?
History of the building. You know? Why not?
No.
Yeah.
I was always under the belief that when the library came to be in 1959, that the lions were part of the library at that time. I was told by Norma Hart, who is a longtime Hudson history person, in fact, she founded our history collection upstairs. She said that when George Power lived here, they were a gift to him from someone. Because I always thought the lions were the library's lions. And
it sort of looked like one the New York City
right.
Library.
That's
right.
Why I was
yeah.
assumed that, you know, in 1959 you've got these lions and you just open up the doors as a library. But I just wondered if you'd come across any other research.
No, I didn't.
Yeah.
No, I didn't. But then again, you know, I was sort of on, like a deadline.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know,
interesting
you like
thing about
something.
When you research, you do tend to get off on tangents. I'd spend like 3 days on something that wasn't in the book. I'm like, oh.